Welcome to NEJM This Week. I'm Dr. Michael Bierer. This week, we look at new studies on early aspirin discontinuation after myocardial infarction, an antiviral pill for dengue prevention, and CRISPR-based gene editing for lipid disorders. We review bedside clinical teaching and present a complex case of seizures and visual disturbances. Perspectives explore antidepressant safety in pregnancy, restoring trust in public health, academic medical centers' venture investments, and a young physician's wrinkled white coat. Early discontinuation of aspirin after PCI in low-risk acute myocardial infarction by Giuseppe Tarantini from the University of Padua Medical School, Italy, and co-authors. The introduction of newer generation drug-eluting stents with lower doses of drugs and improved biocompatibility has markedly reduced the risk of late stent thrombosis. Because of this progress, there has been a renewed interest in refining antiplatelet strategies. This randomized trial, conducted at 40 European sites, evaluated the effects of early discontinuation of aspirin in patients with acute myocardial infarction who had undergone early complete revascularization with a contemporary stent. 1,942 adults with acute myocardial infarction who had undergone successful complete revascularization within 7 days after an infarction and had subsequently completed 1 month of dual antiplatelet therapy without ischemic or major bleeding events were randomly assigned to transition to a P2Y12 inhibitor as monotherapy or to continue dual antiplatelet therapy, aspirin plus a P2Y12 inhibitor, for an additional 11 months. P2Y12 inhibitor monotherapy was non-inferior to continued dual antiplatelet therapy with respect to the occurrence of adverse cardiovascular and cerebrovascular events and resulted in a lower incidence of bleeding events. Early withdrawal of aspirin after PCI in acute coronary syndromes by Patricia Guimarães from the Hospital Israelita Albert Einstein, São Paulo, Brazil, and co-authors. Dual antiplatelet therapy with aspirin and a P2Y12 inhibitor for 12 months is the standard antithrombotic treatment for patients with acute coronary syndromes undergoing percutaneous coronary intervention, PCI. However, this regimen is accompanied by an increase in the risk of bleeding, which is associated with an adverse prognosis. This study evaluated whether potent P2Y12 inhibitor monotherapy without aspirin, initiated shortly after successful PCI, is effective and safe for patients with acute coronary syndromes. 3,410 patients were randomly assigned within the first 4 days of hospitalization to stop treatment with aspirin and receive potent P2Y12 inhibitor monotherapy, ticagrelor or prasugrel, or to receive dual antiplatelet therapy for 12 months. Non-inferiority of monotherapy to dual antiplatelet therapy was not shown with regard to the composite primary outcome of death from any cause, myocardial infarction, stroke, or urgent target vessel revascularization through 12 months of follow-up. Hemorrhagic events were observed somewhat less frequently in the monotherapy group than in the dual antiplatelet therapy group. In an editorial, Jane Leopold, deputy editor for the journal, asks, "How do we incorporate the results of the trials by Tarantini and co-authors and Guimarães and co-authors into practice?" When asked whether aspirin can be discontinued in favor of monotherapy with a P2Y12 inhibitor almost immediately after coronary artery stent implantation during hospitalization for an acute coronary syndrome, we now have evidence that an aspirin-free strategy is not non-inferior to 1 year of dual antiplatelet therapy and should not be considered, despite a reduction in the risk of bleeding events. We also have evidence that discontinuation of aspirin after 1 month of dual antiplatelet therapy and continuation of P2Y12 inhibitor monotherapy is non-inferior to 12 months of dual antiplatelet therapy among low-risk patients and has the potential to mitigate bleeding risk without increasing ischemic risk. However, which particular patients with an acute coronary syndrome are candidates for early discontinuation of aspirin and the timing for discontinuation of aspirin remain to be determined. Daily mosnodinvir as dengue prophylaxis in a controlled human infection model by Anna Durbin from Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, Baltimore, and co-authors. Dengue is an acute disease caused by any of four antigenically different dengue virus serotypes, DEN V1, 2, 3, and 4, that are transmitted to humans by Aedes mosquitoes. Dengue is a growing public health threat. Approximately half the worldwide population is considered by the World Health Organization to be at risk for the disease. Dengue can manifest as undifferentiated fever or non-severe dengue fever. However, in a small proportion of cases, to severe manifestations such as dengue hemorrhagic fever or dengue shock syndrome, with a potentially fatal outcome. Licensed dengue treatments are currently unavailable, and management consists of supportive measures such as antipyretic therapy and volume repletion. This phase 2A trial assessed the prophylactic antiviral activity, safety, and pharmacokinetic profile of different daily doses of mosnodinvir in healthy participants after challenge with an under-attenuated DEN V3 strain in a controlled human infection model. In this initial analysis, a high daily dose of oral mosnodinvir led to a significantly lower DEN V3 RNA load than placebo. Xuping She from the University of Texas Medical Branch, Galveston, writes in an editorial that the trial by Durbin and co-authors establishes proof of concept for mosnodinvir as dengue prophylaxis and provides an important milestone after decades of pursuit of an anti-dengue pill. However, key questions remain. Extrapolation of findings from the current trial to areas where dengue is endemic must be done with caution. The therapeutic window for treatment of dengue is narrow, and although mosnodinvir has shown prophylactic efficacy, effectiveness as a treatment after dengue virus infection remains unproven in humans. Resistance in areas where dengue is endemic could pose challenges. Continued dengue virus surveillance will be essential, and combination therapy may ultimately be necessary to mitigate resistance. Still, this trial represents a pivotal advance in dengue antiviral development. With continued scientific and clinical momentum, the long-sought dengue pill may finally be within reach. Phase 1 trial of CRISPR-Cas9 gene editing targeting ANGPTL3 by Luke Laffin from the Cleveland Clinic Foundation, Ohio, and co-authors. Angiopoietin-like protein 3, ANGPTL3, inhibits lipoprotein and endothelial lipases. ANGPTL3 loss-of-function genetic variants are associated with decreased levels of low-density lipoprotein cholesterol and triglycerides and a decreased lifetime risk of atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease. This Phase 1 trial assessed the safety and efficacy of a single intravenous dose of CTX310, an in vivo CRISPR-Cas9 gene-editing drug product, targeting ANGPTL3 in 15 adults who had uncontrolled hypercholesterolemia, hypertriglyceridemia, or mixed dyslipidemia, and were receiving maximally tolerated lipid-lowering therapy. No dose-limiting toxic effects or serious adverse events attributable to CTX310 were observed. Administration of CTX310 resulted in reductions in the target protein ANGPTL3 with concomitant reductions in levels of atherogenic lipoproteins. Engasertib versus placebo for bleeding in hereditary hemorrhagic telangiectasia by Hani El Samkari from Massachusetts General Hospital, Boston, and co-authors. Hereditary hemorrhagic telangiectasia, HHT, is an autosomal dominant vasculopathy with a prevalence of 1 in 3,800 persons that results from mutations in the activin receptor-like kinase 1, ALK1, signaling pathway, which is critical in angiogenesis and vascular maintenance. HHT is the second most common inherited bleeding disorder worldwide, affects all genders and ethnic groups, and may result in reduced overall survival as compared with the general population. HHT can cause recurrent severe epistaxis, as well as anemia and reduced quality of life. The disease remains without licensed therapies worldwide. This proof-of-concept trial evaluated the safety and efficacy of oral engasertib, a new allosteric selective AKT inhibitor, in 75 patients with HHT. Patients were randomly assigned to receive engasertib at a dose of 30 or 40 milligrams or placebo once daily for 12 weeks. The safety profile of engasertib was similar to that of placebo, except for mild to moderate rash, which resolved in most patients who continued to receive the drug. Engasertib treatment was associated with decreases in epistaxis frequency and duration.
I'm Darren Teichman, a deputy editor at the New England Journal of Medicine. I've been a full-time medical journal editor for over 15 years, but I've never stopped seeing patients. Just like the other full-time physician editors on our team, I continue to practice medicine for a couple of reasons. Most importantly, I love it. It's who I am. It's who I trained to be. I've known many of my patients for over 20 years, and I don't want to lose those connections. I also think seeing patients makes me a better editor. When we sit around the table and discuss papers, my colleagues and I can understand why the questions asked by the research studies we're considering are important or not to practicing clinicians because we see patients ourselves. I love this work because I always learn a lot. And the goal is simple: to help our authors clearly, honestly, and concisely communicate their findings to our readers so they, in turn, can use what they read to help their patients. It certainly helps me take better care of my patients. We're published by the Massachusetts Medical Society, a not-for-profit publisher, and we rely on subscriptions from individual readers, medical schools, and libraries to fund what we do.
Strategies to reinvigorate the bedside clinical encounter. A review article by Brian Garibaldi from Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine, Chicago, and Stephen Russell from the University of Alabama at Birmingham. Modern trainees spend little time with patients, leading to declining bedside skills, diagnostic errors, rising costs, and burnout. This review outlines 6 strategies to reinvigorate a culture of bedside medicine. Clinicians should go to the bedside and observe, practice, and teach an evidence-based and hypothesis-driven physical examination, and create opportunities for intentional practice through structured bedside rounds and teaching sessions. Technology such as point-of-care ultrasonography and artificial intelligence can enhance diagnosis and bring teams together at the bedside. Faculty should seek and provide feedback on clinical skills through direct observation and formative assessments. Finally, educators should acknowledge the power of the bedside encounter beyond diagnosis, fostering curiosity, connection, and equity in patient care. Strengthening bedside teaching combats healthcare inequities, improves professional fulfillment, and avoids burnout, reaffirming that medicine is learned by the bedside and not in the classroom. A 57-year-old woman with visual disturbances and right arm shaking, a case record of the Massachusetts General Hospital by Nancy Wong and colleagues. A 57-year-old woman presented with persistent right visual field disturbances, episodes of right arm and leg shaking, and recurrent seizures over several months. Initial imaging suggested the presence of a convexal subarachnoid hemorrhage attributed to a pial arteriovenous fistula, which was subsequently embolized. Despite treatment, her symptoms progressed, including visual hallucinations, hoarseness, diplopia, and right vocal cord paralysis. imaging revealed nodular T1 hyperintensities in the sulci and leptomeninges with expansion over time and development of hydrocephalus. Cerebrospinal fluid was unrevealing, and multiple EEGs showed no seizure correlate. Ultimately, a brain biopsy revealed malignant melanocytes infiltrating the leptomeninges and cortex. Genetic testing identified a GNAC mutation typical of primary CNS melanocytic tumors. Given findings on imaging, histologic examination, and molecular testing, the lesion was diagnosed as diffuse meningeal melanomatosis. Diffuse meningeal melanomatosis is a rare, aggressive, primary melanocytic tumor of the central nervous system that arises from leptomeningeal melanocytes and is characterized by widespread infiltration of the meninges and underlying brain. Untangling the Risks of Antidepressants in Pregnancy, a Perspective by Krista Hubrechts from the Brigham and Women's Hospital, Boston, and co-authors. On July 21st, the FDA convened an advisory panel to examine the safety of taking selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, SSRIs, during pregnancy. Although SSRIs are among the most commonly used medications during pregnancy, the scientific literature is complex and often conflicting. Early studies suggested that some SSRIs were associated with an approximately 50% increase in fetal cardiac malformations, but large prospective database studies later showed weaker associations. Adjusting for maternal depression accounted for more than half of the observed excess risk, and the risk estimate shifted fully to the null. Similarly, for autism spectrum disorder, crude analyses suggested a strong association, but after controlling for confounding, the association was eliminated. These findings show how powerful confounding by indication and related factors can be. Although observational studies cannot prove that SSRIs pose no risk in pregnancy, current data should reassure women and their families, clinicians, and regulators that treatment with SSRIs carries little or no risk for the most serious adverse outcomes. Restoring Confidence in Public Health, a Perspective by Peter Marks from Washington, D.C. Past progress in public health is now at risk in the United States. The current crisis may be framed as stemming from six comms: complacency, commitment, commercialism, complexity, communication, and comportment. Complacency arises because the benefits of preventive measures may be difficult to perceive. Beliefs about what kind of commitment humans owe to one another have changed, creating greater tension than ever between individual choice and the collective welfare. Commercialism and promises of easy cures have undermined acceptance of appropriately developed public health interventions. Complexity and rapid, unvetted communication have further eroded trust, while public health officials are no longer trusted by many Americans. Without intervention, the current crisis could have quite disturbing consequences, including a reversal of centuries of progress. The author calls for improved and refocused scientific education, clear communication, and patient and respectful dialogue to restore trust. Ultimately, all of us must have the courage to take on the current challenges. Venture Capital Investments by U.S. Academic Medical Centers, a Perspective by Nishant Uppal from Massachusetts General Hospital and Zuri Song from Harvard Medical School, both in Boston. In this new era of uncertainty about traditional sources of revenue, U.S. academic medical centers, AMCs, may become increasingly reliant on alternative revenue sources, including returns from venture capital investments. Over the past 15 years, venture capital investment by hospitals or health systems affiliated with a university or medical school has grown rapidly. Since 2010, the venture capital funds affiliated with 10 leading U.S. AMCs collectively participated in at least 453 investment deals, totaling approximately $12.1 billion. Venture capital activity is part of an evolution of AMCs toward developing new revenue streams that supplement patient care, research, education, and philanthropy. but this shift may introduce tension between long-standing efforts to advance the AMC mission and new demands to become savvy investors in emerging, sometimes risky, areas. As federal funding streams become less certain, AMCs may see the pursuit of venture capital investments as increasingly necessary. A Wrinkled White Coat, a perspective by Mark Pacult from St. Joseph's Hospital and Medical Center, Phoenix, Arizona. It was still early in the morning. Dr. Pacult had learned the routine by now, even though it was only late July in his internship year. Round on patients as efficiently as possible, stopping in before families could muster from the pullout couches, and make sure that no patient's neurologic exam findings had worsened. Send the patients who'd undergone spine surgery to the floor, keep those with subarachnoid hemorrhages in the ICU until post-bleed day 14, and make sure the pressures from any external ventricular drains didn't exceed 20 millimeters of water. If anything deviated from the established plan, it was still the fact that it had deviated and not the actual situation that caused panic. It was still early enough in Dr. Pacult's career that it surprised him, even shocked him somewhat, when things went wrong, when patients did poorly, when wrinkles appeared in the plans that he thought he was merely safeguarding, merely overseeing, not actively managing. It was still early when the nurse called Dr. Pacult back to the bedside of a patient with a ruptured cerebral arteriovenous malformation. The fact that the patient's brain was now, as the nurse kindly helped Dr. Pacult to see, herniating and causing an infarct in his pituitary gland was a wrinkle that he was neither expecting nor prepared to handle. A nearby senior resident helped to stabilize the patient, but it soon became clear that no amount of heroics would save his life. The weight of the morning shifted. Soon, they'd have to do what for Dr. Pacult was still unthinkable. Tell a family their loved one was officially, certifiably, dead. In our images in clinical medicine, a 76-year-old man with coronary artery disease and heart failure with reduced ejection fraction presented with an 8-month history of progressive breast enlargement and tenderness. Spironolactone had been started 4 years before presentation. In another image, a 26-year-old woman presented with a one-day history of a mobile serpiginous lesion in her left upper eyelid, shown in a video at nejm.org. She reported owning a dog. Surgical excision of the lesion was performed. Read more from our issue at nejm.org. Let us know what you think about our podcast. Any comments or suggestions may be sent to audio@nejm.org. Thank you for listening.